you would be just stupid to miss this movie.
My sex change operation got botched. My guardian angel fell asleep on the watch.
I'd set up a shot in the morning and then go do the makeup and hair, and I would coax myself out of the trailer. Come on, honey, you're wonderful.
I'm a fabulist by trade, so be forewarned. This makes me less than reliable when it comes to the facts.
My art's not made like that, no. My art's not meant for that, no. No, my art's not made like that, no. My art's not dressed for that.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Anti-gay prejudice scuttles major Australian pension law reform, a U.S. appeals court finds anti-gay discrimination wrong but legal, and Hedwig and the Angry Inch, the man, the lady, and the movie. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 11th, 2001. The Australian government lost its major pension reform bill this week rather than meet the third-party Australian Democrats' demand for equal treatment for gay and lesbian couples. The Superannuation Legislation Amendment Bill had been in process in the federal legislature for 3 years before its 35-31 defeat this week in the Senate. The bill was commonly known as Super Choice because it would have allowed workers rather than employers to choose where pension funds would be invested. The Australian Democrats had recently failed in two other efforts to extend equal pension rights to same-gender couples, one for federal government employees and one for members of parliament. Australia's pension industry strongly supports equal treatment for gays and lesbians, but is limited in practice by discriminatory federal laws. Veteran gay activist Rodney Croom said that Prime Minister John Howard's government's obstinacy this week had thrown its economic credibility to the wind by putting prejudice before sound financial policy. In Croom's home state of Tasmania, gay and lesbian couples won a victory this week as the Tasmanian Industrial Commission determined that bereavement leave should be extended to unmarried survivors. Although the current decision applies only to certain medical personnel in Tasmania, the Health and Community Services Union will pressure the Australian Industrial Relations Commission to apply the same standard nationally.
The Australian government further riled activists this week by announcing it will join the nation's Catholic bishops in a lawsuit to allow states to deny fertility services to women not in relationships with men. Australia's highest court is expected to hear the case in September. The bishops are appealing a federal court ruling that struck down Victoria's state law limiting access to fertility services. That court found the law violated the Federal Sex Discrimination Act's prohibition against marital status discrimination. The Howard government had previously introduced an amendment to the Sex Discrimination Act to authorize states to limit fertility treatment, but that bill is expected to fail if it reaches a floor vote.
In Ireland, news that a Dublin gay couple had fathered triplets by a California surrogate mother sparked calls for government regulation of reproductive technology. Biological father Gerard Whelan and his partner John McMahon are believed to be Ireland's first gay dads by means of surrogacy. Unlike Britain, Ireland currently has no laws covering surrogacy. But the Fine Gael party is now concerned that some may use surrogacy to sidestep Ireland's strict regulation of adoptions, and independent Senator Mary Henry renewed her call for surrogacy legislation she had introduced 3 years ago. Both Henry and Fine Gael denied that their concerns related to the gay dad's sexual orientation.
Returning to employment issues, in the U.S., Indiana Democratic Governor Frank O'Bannon this week signed into effect a new state employment policy prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination. It covers hiring, development, advancement, and firing decisions, and a promise that we will strive to maintain a working environment free of sexual harassment and intimidation. Indiana state government employees who feel they've experienced discrimination will have recourse through the administrative system. Indiana is the 9th state to adopt such an equal opportunity employment policy, in addition to 11 states barring discrimination in both public and private employment.
Illinois Republican Governor George Ryan is actively lobbying for addition of sexual orientation as a category protected under that state's Human Rights Act from discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodations, and financial transactions. Ryan, who announced this week he will not seek a second term, wrote a 5-page letter to Illinois legislators urging them to pass the civil rights bill activists have sought for 2 decades. Ryan's letter was part of his amendatory veto of a bill intended to open public accommodations to motorcyclists. He told lawmakers he would sign their bikers' rights bill if they added the words sexual orientation.
But August began with yet another U.S. appeals court, finding that federal law against sex discrimination and sexual harassment does not extend to discrimination and harassment based on sexual orientation. A 3-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit upheld a trial court's dismissal of John Bibby's lawsuit against the Philadelphia Coca-Cola Bottling Company. Bibby claimed his co-workers harassed and physically attacked him after learning he is gay. The appellate ruling said, "Harassment on the basis of sexual orientation has no place in our society. Congress has not yet seen fit, however, to provide protection against such harassment." Although there have been similar decisions by other federal appeals panels, this one received special attention, coming as ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, was reintroduced in Congress. Opponents of civil rights protections for gays and lesbians have falsely claimed that they are already adequately covered by federal law.
Gay men in Michigan breathed a sigh of relief this week as the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office announced it would no longer prosecute men charged as a result of undercover police stings. The announcement came in conjunction with a decision not to prosecute a county judge caught in a sting. But the decision came thanks in large part to persistent lobbying by Michigan's Triangle Foundation, which claimed that some 800 men had been charged for merely flirting with decoy cops in Detroit's Rouge Park. In many cases, police had impounded the men's cars, which could be recovered only by paying a $900 fee. Wayne County Prosecutor Mike Duggan said, "I'm not going to charge people criminally for what they thought was a consensual act between adults. We do not send female officers into sports bars to come on to guys to see which ones respond and arrest them. We should not be sending undercover decoys to do exactly the same thing."
California transsexuals were disappointed this week as Democratic Governor Gray Davis vetoed a bill that would have made it easier to obtain revised birth certificates. Davis's veto message said only, "I find no compelling reason to expand existing law and therefore cannot sign this measure."
By contrast, the chair of South Korea's ruling party spoke out on the internet this week in support of allowing transsexuals to change their official registration numbers to reflect their self-identified gender. Millennium Democratic Party Chair Kim Jung-kwang said his opinion was a personal one and the issue should be publicly debated. Personifying the issue in South Korea is trans woman model and entertainer Ha Ri-soo, who sought to change her registration number. Lately, she's captured the heart of Lottie Giants baseball star Jose Felix, who shows off the message, "Jose loves Ha Ri-soo," on his arm. One South Korean wedding business is planning a public wedding ceremony at no cost exclusively for transsexuals and their partners.
Hopes for legal recognition of gay and lesbian couples in Brazil are fading. A version of a bill first introduced in 1995 to create registered partnerships with many of the benefits of marriage was finally expected to come to a vote earlier this year. But opposition, led by religious conservatives, knocked it off the agenda once again. Leading gay and lesbian activists told Reuters this week that they don't expect a vote this year. They also agree there is no way the bill would pass in 2002, an election year. Activists in Argentina are petitioning to revitalize their similar 3-year-old national bill for civil unions. It's been stalled for 16 months in a legislative committee of the National Chamber of Deputies.
Canada extended asylum to a lesbian couple this week for the first time, although individual lesbians have been given refuge in the past from homophobic persecution. The couple had both experienced physical and sexual violence from police, strangers, and family in their homeland of Mexico, and feared further persecution if they returned. They fled in 1999 to Toronto, where an immigration board approved their request for asylum this week.
The Society for the German Language is inviting the public to suggest new words to describe gay and lesbian families, including terms for the partners, parents, and in-laws. Officially, the registered life partnerships that went into effect in Germany are known as eingetragene Lebenspartnerschaft, which even Germans find unwieldy. More colloquially, Germans are saying Homo-Ehe for homo-marriage. But the society objects on two grounds. Partnerships are legally different from marriages, and in Germany, as elsewhere, the term homo carries negative connotations.
And finally, those connotations of homo also became quite an issue for the New York Times, whose Sunday crossword puzzle this past week was entitled Homo Names. The distinguished paper quickly put out a remarkable statement insisting the title referred solely to some answers being homonyms of well-known names and not to any gay slur or outings. In case you've forgotten, homonyms are words pronounced alike but spelled differently. Yet four principal answers referred to widely rumored to be gay actor-singer Jim Nabors and critic Rex Reed, gay icon Bette Midler, and lifestyle reporter Robin Leach. Leach actually felt compelled to respond with a statement insisting on his heterosexuality. Correspondents of MSNBC's Eric Alterman identified 22 clues in the puzzle that might imply gay references, such as people who live next to a Y, and add more lubricant. If, as the paper said, that was all coincidence, an even bigger one came as the Monday puzzle included the answers, "Excuse me, please, I'm terribly sorry, and I beg your pardon."
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 11th, 2001, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
A veteran novelist and a new literary voice each speak their minds later in the program. With critics comparing it to the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Pink Floyd's The Wall, the movie version of John Cameron Mitchell's hit off-Broadway musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch is now playing in theaters across America. Hedwig was the darling of the Sundance Film Festival, where it won the Audience Award and Mitchell was named Best Director. The film went on to take honors at festivals in Berlin, San Francisco, and Seattle. This Way Out's Steve Pride inches up on John Cameron Mitchell to get a better look at the man and the lady at the center of it all.
One of the best film performances of the year comes from John Cameron Mitchell as an East German glam rocker searching for identity after a botched sex change operation. Hedwig and the Angry Inch doesn't boast a particularly complicated storyline, but the pleasure is in the experience. And its opening in Los Angeles was an absolute love fest.
This is Cameron Manheim.
What do you think of Hedwig?
Well, I've seen it probably a dozen times in New York as a play. I was not sure how it was going to translate. It's fantastic. It was so exciting. John Cameron Mitchell is like an angel from heaven. He is so spectacular. You would be just stupid to miss this movie.
My sex change operation got botched. My guardian angel fell asleep on the watch. Now all I've got is a Barbie doll crotch. I've got an angry inch. 6 inches forward and 5 inches back. I got an angry inch.
Well, it started out in rock clubs and then theater. And all these people showed up at the theater. Like, suddenly there was Danny DeVito and Glenn Close, you know, in this Fleabag hotel we were performing. And then there's Marilyn Manson, not far from Barry Manilow, and they seemed to get along, and a lot of them wanted to make a movie, you know, production companies and distributors. And we actually had a bit of a choice, and New Line Cinema was a place that the composer and I had a lot of contacts with. And it was really dreamy with New Line creatively. It was much more about logistics and money and stamina, you know, directing myself. That was more like the hell. What I had to do was kind of 16-hour days, and I'd set up a shot in the morning and then go do the makeup and hair, and I would coax myself out of the trailer. Come on, honey, you're wonderful, you're beautiful.
I put on some makeup, turn on the 8-track, I'm pulling the wig down from the shelf. Suddenly I'm
the director's not there, you get people kind of bickering a little bit, you know, like sometimes the DP, the cinematographer, and the editor would fight, and really it's the director's, you know, has to make the final decision, but I was going to get my nails done, you know, and sometimes I even let them do shots without me while I had to do the hair. I would set it up, and they would shoot it, and then bring the video back to me to tell me if it was okay or if I should shoot another one, which was really weird. And then one time I knew it was the limit. I actually was looking at the video, and then I gave notes to the actor on the walkie while my hair was being dried. And he said, what? Over. You know, what? Could you cry more? Could you cry? Is this working? Could you cry? And then I realized we have to slow down a little bit more. And so that kind of thing was absurd and funny the first time, but, you know, after the 20th day, it wasn't quite as hilarious. And I'd have to check the playback, do a take, maybe three takes in a row to keep the energy going. And then I would run back to the video to check the playback and up a hill in stilettos because it was too late to get the boots or whatever. So I'd be climbing around with the wig and the heels and the dresses. And at first it was kind of funny for everyone. And then we kind of got into this groove. And by the end, you know, we had the Teamsters in wigs on our drag day, which is pretty fun.
I've got a sweet tooth, licorice drops and jelly rolls. Hey, sugar daddy, Hansel needs some sugar in his bowl. I'll lay out fine china on the linen and polish up the chrome. If you've got some sugar for me, sugar daddy, bring it home.
When I first did Hedwig, I was kind of scared of it. When you're a guy and you're gay, the first thing you know is it's very uncool to be feminine. In fact, women figure that out around the same time, that it's kind of uncool to be feminine. Don't be a girl. So I was kind of afraid of it for a while, but people would say, oh, you should just try it. It really brings out things. And it's like, it reminded me of being in acting class and you'd use a mask and it would free up your body, you know. So I was forced to do the female character because this club was a drag club and it was the only place I had to play. So I got Hedwig together and really thought about it for months. Every one-liner, you know, I was like very researched and written out. And it was the first time I'd been with a band, which was actually more scary because I couldn't really hear myself. I'd been used to doing Broadway stuff. And it was just like an explosion.
On August 13th, 1961, a wall was erected on the middle of the city of Berlin. The world was divided by a Cold War, and the Berlin Wall was the most hated symbol of that divide. Reviled, graffitied, spit upon, we thought the wall would stand forever. And now that it's gone, we don't know who we are anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, Hedwig is like that wall, standing before you in a divide between East and West, slavery and freedom, man and woman, top and bottom.
Now I remember I did the tuck, you know, which some drag queens do, which is like you kind of like, you know, move your package sort of in a certain, and you got a tight, and you have a, and it's very uncomfortable, and it's like, it's supposed to make, you know, the dress lay better. And drag queens there were showing me what to do, and it was like, I don't know if I'm into this, and because then I get to the club, and they can only see me from the head up, and I'm tucked, and I'm like, I can't untuck now, and so it was like completely exciting, and I actually felt kind of more masculine than I'd ever felt, and more feminine, and it's funny, the people who kind of were attracted to me, it's like a lot of women were attracted to me, dressed as a woman. I got all this kind of attention I'd never got from people, and it was very powerful. Drag is sort of like the priest or priestess of gay cultures, and you know, everyone sort of parts for a nun, whether you're Catholic or not. You move aside for a nun or a priest because of the drag, right? There's no other reason.
Now there was three sexes, then one that looked like two men glued up back to back. They called the children of the sun. Similar in shape and girth was the children of the earth. They look out, two girls rolled up in one. And the children of the moon was like a fork shoved on a spoon. They was but some part of our daughter Parton. The origin of love.
The whole last 20 minutes is kind of like a rock concert, right? There's no dialogue after a certain point. And we wanted to have that kind of feeling of free association that you get in a concert, because you have a big story up to then, and then you have Hedwig going into her own head. And going into her head, she she kind of evolves and realizes that perhaps rather than being half a woman or half a man, she's both, and that's better than one. So you see the tattoo kind of coming together, you see the drag stripped away, and you see her walking into the world. And it's not necessarily a bullying moment, but it's a realistic, hopeful, I think, inclusive moment. I mean, she kind of includes her audience. However extreme she is, it's always like she assumes that everyone understands who's listening. I like the kind of game of, like, what's exactly going on here, gender-wise? I like that kind of confusion, because that's how I feel in life. I'm gay, and I remember asking out this cute boy who I met at the Starbucks years ago, and we were actually making out, and it was a girl. I only found it out when we were making out. And I, of all people, who is aware of the variety of gender play in the world, it was like I was thrown. And it was exciting. It was fun.
This has been a conversation with John Cameron Mitchell. Hedwig and the Angry Inch is a New Line release. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Mr. Patty, Gina, and Yoko, Aretha, Nico, me, and all the strange rock and rollers. You know you're doing all right, so hold on to each other.
Tales of the City author Armistead Maupin's latest book, The Night Listener, has been called his most autobiographical work to date. But how much of it is really for real? Well, the answer to that question is open to some literary license, as Maupin explains in this excerpt.
I'm a fabulist by trade, so be forewarned. I've spent years looting my life for fiction. Like a magpie, I save the shiny stuff and discard the rest. It's of no use to me if it doesn't serve the geometry of the story. This makes me less than reliable when it comes to the facts. Ask Jess Carmody, who lived with me for 10 years and observed this affliction firsthand. He even had a name for it, the jeweled elephant syndrome, after a story I once told him about an old friend from college. My friend, whose name was Boyd, joined the Peace Corps in the late 60s. He was sent to a village in India where he fell in love with a local girl and eventually proposed to her. But Boyd's blue-blooded parents back in South Carolina were so aghast at the prospect of dusky grandchildren that they refused to attend the wedding in New Delhi. So Boyd sent them photographs. The bride turned out to be an aristocrat of the highest caste, better bred by far than any member of Boyd's family. The couple had been wed in regal splendor, perched atop a pair of jeweled elephants. Boyd's parents, imprisoned in their middle-class snobbery, had managed to miss the social event of a lifetime. I had told that story so often that Jess knew it by heart. So when Boyd came to town on business and met Jess for the first time, Jess was sure he had the perfect opener. "Well," he said brightly, "Gabriel tells me you got married on an elephant." Boyd just blinked at him in confusion. I could already feel myself reddening. "You weren't?" "No," Boyd said with an uncomfortable laugh. "We were married in a Presbyterian church." Jess said nothing, but he gave me a heavy-lidded stare whose meaning I had long before learned to decipher. You were never to be trusted with the facts. In my defense, the essence of the story had been true. Boyd had indeed married an Indian girl he had met in the Peace Corps, and she had proved to be quite rich. And Boyd's parents, who were in fact exceptionally stuffy, had always regretted that they'd missed the wedding. I don't know what to say about those elephants, except that I believed in them utterly. They certainly never felt like a lie, more like a kind of shorthand for a larger, less satisfying truth. Most stories have holes in them that cry out for jeweled elephants. And my instinct, alas, is to supply them. Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of The Night Listener, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
And finally this week, a few words from award-winning lesbian slam poet, spoken word performer Alex Olson from her debut CD, Built Like That.
Some are just just like a teacup when you're looking for a beer. Some art, it scares you, and some art's about the fear. Some art is a highbrow thing. Some art's about the eyebrow ring. Some art's about the tattoo. Some art's about the artist, and that art's not meant for you.
No, but my art's not made like that. No, my art's not meant for that. No, my art's not built like that. No, my art's not dressed for that.
Some art's Ecclesiastes. Some art's about the sin. Some art, it seems just heavenly, and that's great if let's in.
Some art's all multicolored, till it goes behind the scene. It comes out all multi-corporate, then it only comes in green.
Yeah, but my art's not made like that. No, my art's not meant for that. No, my art's not built like that. No, my art's not dressed for that.
Some art's a one-hit wonder. Why they think we're deaf and dumb. It's like the disciples at Last Supper. If God fed them bubble gum. Yeah, some art's pedigree whitewash. A cryptic clean cover-up. My art don't need no ivory badge to back up what's in its gut.
My art's just made like that.
No, my art's not meant for that. No, my art's not built like that. No, my art's not dressed for that. The Mona Lisa, and she's looking straight at you.
Yeah,
my art wears the same clothes 7 days a week, cause my art don't seem to care about what other people think. Yeah, some art's real nice to look at, some art's all neat and clean. My art forgot her tampon and she's bleeding through her jeans. Yeah, my art don't need no tampon, she'll just bleed through her jeans. Yeah, my art don't need no tampon, she'll just bleed through her jeans.
Yeah,
my art's just neat like that. My art's just meant for that, yeah. My art's just built like that, yeah. My art's just dressed for that, yeah. My art's just made like that,
yeah.
My art's just meant for that, yeah, yeah. My art's just built like that. My art's just dressed for that, yeah. My art's just made like that,
yeah.
My art's just meant for that, yeah. My art's just built like that, yeah. My heart's just built like that.
That was lesbian slam poet Alex Olson performing the title cut from her debut CD, Built Like That. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Graham Underhill, Damian Meyer, Chris Ambidge, Jason Lynn, Brian Nunes, Rex Walkner, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For an urgent message about This Way Out's critical financial situation, please visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WMPG Gorham, Maine, Plains FM, Christchurch, New Zealand, KXCI, Tucson, Arizona, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And everybody's going to stay tuned.